Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
Tuesday, the 28th of October. Welcome, 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 friends, to the show. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Today on the show, something a little different. You ready?
Yes, ready, CG? I'm ready.
Okay, we're going to skip the local news chat and get right into the main topic. Next week, three justices on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court are up for election, but they're not running against anybody.
No, the vote next week is a retention vote. Here in the Commonwealth, every 10 years, the Supreme Court justices, they go before the people and we get a chance to retain them or reject them. It's a simple yes or no. On the ballot this year are three Democratic justices, David Wecht, Christine Donahue, and Kevin Dougherty.
Right now, Democrats hold a 5-2 edge on the high court. If voters reject all three, there would be another election in 2027 to pick a new trio of judges. And that could totally alter the court's balance of power. As this crucial election nears, we get a chance today to hear a rare fireside chat that Cherry hosted in September with Wecht, Donahue, and Dougherty at Philly Central High School. The forum was organized by Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts and the Committee of 70.
The Supreme Court is the final guardian of our Constitution here in Pennsylvania, which means their decisions can overrule lower court opinions and laws passed by our state representatives, like congressional maps they overturned a few years ago. I asked the justices how they each see the role of the court at a time of deep political division. Justice Kevin Dougherty answered first.
The independence of the judiciary, it's a sacred part of our Constitution that for some reason people believe it should just be a suggestion. The concept of an independent judiciary is incredibly important to remaining as a democratic backstop in Pennsylvania. It's how the Constitution was written. It's for the perfection of making sure that no one particular side has enough authority to impose tyranny on another. 300 years later, it still remains.
Thank you. Justice Wecht.
It's an excellent question, Cherry. And you identified an important issue, which is that the court is often called upon to make a decision which would go against the will of a temporal majority. And the Constitution is the fundamental law and is superior to a legislative enactment. So there are times when the court must stand against the popular will, which is very much different from the political branches, the legislative and executive branch of government. So it's not for the faint-hearted. You know, if Brown versus Board of Education were put to a plebiscite in 1954, the public would not have approved it. It is the job of the courts to stand against the popular will sometimes, and that's the job in constitutional matters. In our system, as you mentioned, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court is the final word on Pennsylvania law. The last thing I'll say is we are a common law court, so we are making the common law of Pennsylvania, that is to say, building on precedents, which is a very important area of our jurisprudence.
Thank you very much, Justice Wecht. Justice Donahue.
There's probably no more important time for there to be a Pennsylvania Supreme Court whose job is to interpret, obey, and protect the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Everyone generally looks at constitutional rights as those flowing from the federal Constitution. And the fact of the matter is, as Pennsylvanians, your rights, our rights, in many situations, just exceed those rights that are offered by the United States Constitution. And it becomes incredibly important when we deal with the Article I rights under the Pennsylvania Constitution, because they are our inherent rights. No one is giving you those rights. They're rights that are inherent to you as a person. That's the opposite of what the United States Constitution does. The United States Constitution looks at it from the opposite direction. And so over the course of the time that we've been on the Supreme Court, we have had numerous opportunities to compare and contrast what the Pennsylvania Constitution protects, where the United States Constitution does not. We're often called upon to not only interpret the text of our own Constitution, but to look at all of the precedent that came before to decide what exactly our Constitution means. It is, needless to say, one of the most important things that we do.
Thank you very much. I want to talk about impartiality because judges are expected to be impartial. Yet in Pennsylvania, all three of you first ran as Democrats. This year, no party affiliation will appear on the ballot. How do you ensure that your rulings are not political? Walk us through the thought process that you kind of go through to make sure that it's not a political decision. Justice Donahue, we'll start with you, then we'll go to Justice Dougherty, then Justice Wecht.
Our personal views, our political views, our religious views are left on the wayside. They have absolutely nothing to do with the manner in which we can decide cases and do decide cases. The fact of the matter is that there are, in fact, rules of construction or otherwise that are in place to make certain that we are guided in our decision-making process. We don't work with a blank blackboard. It never works that way. Probably the thing that guides me, and I think all of us who serve on the Supreme Court, is that the issue of partisanship just does not enter into the equation. If you look at David and Kevin and I and our decisions, you mentioned that we were all elected as Democrats. Mm-hmm. We disagree with each other all the time. And that's a function of the interpretive process that we individually go through when we're presented with an issue. And that's true with our colleagues who were elected as Republicans. Partisanship, honestly, has never been part of the function of my jurisprudence.
Thank you. Justice Dougherty.
The clearest, easiest answer is that we have 10 years of jurisprudence. If you think that we bring our religious, our personal, our political, our ideological thoughts to an opinion or a decision, as I indicated, Exhibit A is 10 years of our judicial opinion. I believe our writings speak for themselves, that we have taken stances that would some may consider adverse to those quote-unquote labels. I think, as we all understood, the Constitution required us to run as a partisan. But the moment we were elected, when we put that black robe on, we hung up that partisan title. And we have watched ourselves accordingly. And when you look at the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, you'll never hear us say it's how many Democrats, how many Republicans. We say that we're seven.
Thank you. Justice Wecht.
Yes, there's no circumstance in which any of us or our four colleagues look at a case and say to ourselves or to the group, this is the Democratic result or this is the Republican result. We have to apply the law as we interpret it to exist and apply it. And the result is going to be what the result is going to be. But it's the process that we must ensure is fair and following predictable rules. We have these three prongs of our jurisprudence, and in none of them do we embark on like some Democratic mission or some Republican mission. It's just that the people of Pennsylvania decided that the way their judges are going to be selected is in these partisan elections. But once we take the oath of office, that's past history.
Yeah, you shed those political affiliations. I have a follow-up for you, Justice Wecht. In 2018, there was controversy over your participation in a redistricting case, with some calling for your disqualification, and some Republicans even tried to impeach you. That effort failed, but to the extent you can speak to it, what did you learn from that experience about yourself, about your role, and about the public perception of the court?
What I learned, I think, is that the court hit a nerve because we took away a prized possession of some highly partisan actors in our system who had created a flamboyantly gerrymandered map, was an insult to democracy, and was Exhibit A nationwide for the most obscene U.S. House map of any state in our nation. It's a fundamental principle in our system that if if one seeks to recuse a jurist, one makes a motion in advance of the proceeding. One doesn't wait for the result to see if one likes the result and then complain that maybe that person shouldn't have participated. So I learned that when we make a decision striking down something that was grossly improper, there are going to be people who are behind the impropriety who are going to be very upset.
Thank you for that. Justice Dougherty or Justice Donahue, any thoughts about the perception of the court, anything you've learned over the years sitting on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court?
No matter how you try to convince people otherwise, they're always going to assume we're political. I jokingly tell people, Justice Weck is our great dissenter. And if you want to know how he feels about an opinion that we disagree on, all you have to do is read his dissent.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of our system.
So dissents are the most fun, in my opinion. You really can have a lot of fun with dissents.
And yeah. They're good because someday in the future, they may be the majority position. Because that's how the law develops. We oftentimes look to dissents when we're asked to look at a new view of an issue and say, there was a point there that really deserves a little bit more development. So, I mean, this whole thing is a process.
Yeah. And let's talk about the process, because the average Pennsylvanian has no idea how the state's high court works. So, Justice Dougherty, I want you to take us to school for a couple minutes, and walk us through how a case sort of moves through the court. From the petition, how do you all decide which cases to take, to the decision?
Our court is different than any other court in the Commonwealth in which we decide which cases we want. I would say probably, 3,000 requests for us to take the case, and we only accept about maybe 5 to 8% of them. But since there's 7 of us, and I believe last year there were close to 2,100 granted requests, so that means each of us have to review 300 request, bringing in the trial file, reviewing the document, having a law clerk review it, coming up with a decision whether it's worthy of our review. We have to prepare a memorandum, and we have to pass that around to the other 6 while they do the same. So while we're reading each of those decisions, 2 of us have to decide if we agree with the author requesting granting, and then it will be put on. Many times, a request to deny or request to grant may be met with a counter request because, again, just because we don't disagree in our opinions, we also don't disagree in the types of cases we should take. We're doing this while and in conjunction with us preparing for the next session. For example, this week we're sitting for 3 days. We have about 17 cases on the list, so that's 17 huge trial files that we're going to review while we're doing the other 300. Also, while we're doing that, we are still writing the opinions from cases that we had heard at the last session. In between those moments of freedom, we're making decisions regarding the administrative aspects of our court as to whether someone needs to be appointed to overrule, whether an attorney should be disbarred. So each day, every day, it's a product of intellectual jumping jacks. And each chamber permits itself to determine what it finds to be the priority at that particular moment. So unlike any other job, every day's an adventure.
I just want to say that hearing you describe your day-to-day, I was like, woo, that's you all are working. So you're telling us there's a lot of things going on at
the same
time.
A lot of reading.
Yeah, a lot of reading, a lot of review. So Justices Wacht and Donahue, I mean, tell us about this debate, because you talked about how you all disagree. Tell us about what the deliberations look like, what the debates look like. Do you walk to each other's chambers? Like, what's going on behind the scenes?
Well, I think the first place that you can see whether or not there's going to be a debate is during our oral arguments. Mm-hmm. And PCN is wonderful because they televise all of our oral arguments. And you could tell at that juncture where each of us is coming from on any particular issue. When we ask questions, those questions are very illuminative of what we're thinking about a case. And that way we could tell what our colleagues are thinking about the case also. Immediately after an oral argument, we have an administrative session where we take a preliminary vote on the outcome of a case. Every once in a while, we'll have a discussion of the issues, more so to get us in perspective of what we should look at first in terms of what we're voting on. But the real debate takes place in our writings. Every case is assigned a majority author, and the majority author is chosen by being part of the court that got the majority opinion. So that would require, generally speaking, it would take four votes, and then you are one of that four, and you get the majority. Once you write and circulate, and let me tell you, that could take a considerable amount of time, depending on what the case is. But I'm going to use sort of a rule of thumb. Let's say it takes 3 or 4 months to circulate the majority opinion. We have a timeline for when the dissenting opinion has to be filed. And so I, on occasion, will call one of my colleagues who writes a majority opinion and say, Kevin, I can agree except for the portion of the opinion that cites to a case that I have a problem with. Can you accommodate me on that? And sometimes that'll happen. Other times it won't, and then I will have to write a concurring opinion. And so really the debate, to the extent that we actually get to express ourselves and then respond to that expression, really takes place in writing.
Deciding what to decide, as Justice Dougherty mentioned, is a really big part of our job. So we turn away the vast majority of appeals brought to us because we're a court of almost exclusively discretionary jurisdiction. Sometimes, having decided to hear a case, it ends up that the case fizzles out because one of the parties has waived a claim, one of the parties has sown a defect in the record somehow that we weren't aware of, or maybe there's been a death or something unexpected of that nature. In addition to what my colleagues have described, another thing that happens is we often change our minds. So
that's what I was wondering. Yeah. So have you convinced each other to change minds?
So speaking for myself, I mean, I come into an oral argument and I'm really interested in what the lawyers are going to say. And based on what they say and what the give and take from my colleagues is, my whole orientation to a case may change. I may have misapprehended something, and I get corrected, and it takes me in a different direction. And then when we go back and we have our conference, the back and forth often leads me to change. Then, when opinions start circulating, there are often things that take things in a different direction. So votes can change, and really the public sees the tip of the iceberg, or maybe a better metaphor than an iceberg is a water polo game where you see the ball up here, but you don't see the kicking and gouging going on underneath the surface. So there's a lot that's going on, and a lot of things can change on the road to the final published opinions.
And right before we wrap this up, I want you to take like a minute and just tell us, what does the collegiality look like between you all? And, you know, have you learned something from each other? Justice Dougherty.
Absolutely. For 10 years, I was the only one from Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. So I was able to experience Allegheny at its finest. And then when we have Justice Mundy, who's coming from Tioga, I never stepped foot in Wellsboro. But now I've experienced, you know, the top of the state. Personally, it's rewarding. You develop friendships. I believe this is a truly collegial court where all seven of us enjoy each other's company. And I'd have to share with you that the majority of our conversations are I'm trying to inquire as to David's kids, how they're doing in law school, or we talk about Justice Donahue's dog and what's happening with her princess. We're lawyers that were lucky, and we're just hoping that we still have 10 years of luck ahead of us.
You're listening to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. The last voice you heard was Justice Kevin Dougherty. He's one of the three judges on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court who are running for retention in next week's election, along with Justices David Wecht and Christine Donahue.
We're listening back to a condensed version of our fireside chat recorded last month at Central High School.
Toward the end of the show, we'll hear a debate from two analysts who will make the case for and against retaining the justices. Now, let's continue with Cherry's conversation with the justices about their experience, court transparency, nonpartisan voting, and friendship.
I learned a lot from my colleagues. I learned from Justice Daugherty all of the time about procedures and particular issues in Philadelphia. I learned from Justice Wecht about family division issues yeah. that he saw when he was on the Court of Common Pleas in Allegheny County. So yes, I learned almost every day from the interactions with my colleagues, all of whom I like very much. I think it would be fair to say that we all have that feeling about each other. We are a very collegial court along those lines.
Yeah. Each of you have initiatives that you've been working on throughout your tenure, and so I want to talk about that mm-hmm. a little bit. And I want to start with you, Justice Donahue. You've worked to expand opportunities for young lawyers to gain courtroom experience. Could you tell us a little bit about Project Litigate?
Sure, I can. I come from the trial bar. I was a civil trial lawyer for about 28 years, and one of the finest moments in my career was taking a jury verdict. It is a pleasure to have a jury of my client's peers give a result after a trial. The problem we have is that there are fewer and fewer trials. And there are a lot of reasons for that, but you just take my word for it. We are down to maybe 500 jury trials a year in Pennsylvania in the civil cases. That is a drop-off of, 200% over the course of the past 20 years. Our Constitution ensures, guarantees Pennsylvanians a right to a jury trial in civil cases. And so if we are going to be certain that that guarantee can be fulfilled, we have to train trial lawyers. And so what Project Litigate is about is making certain that law firms who have young lawyers who desire to be trial lawyers get an opportunity to stand on their feet in a courtroom. And the trial judges across Pennsylvania have been extremely cooperative and have embraced this effort yes. and have created rules to make it easier for older lawyers to allow younger lawyers to stand up in a courtroom by letting them do follow-up questions if they think the young lawyer yeah. missed something. Fact of the matter is they never do. Because you give a young lawyer the opportunity to question a witness, they are going to be so prepared that they aren't going to miss yes. anything, and that's exactly what's happened. So that's some in substance what Project Litigate is about.
Thank you. I can feel your passion, Justice Donahue, on that. Justice Daugherty, in 2020, you launched the Autism in the Courts Initiative. Can you tell us what inspired it and what progress has been made? And you have 2 minutes.
Sure. Thank you. As a judge, I learned that malice doesn't cause great harm alone. Or I should say harm is not caused by malice alone. Sometimes ignorance and a lack of empathy can do the same. And as a result of a personal experience, when I sat as a judge at 18th and Vine in family court, I had a child that I was ready to adjudge delinquent, which would have caused this young man to be a convicted felon the rest of his life and to acquire a prior record score, which would have sent that child to State Road where our prisons are, as opposed to State College where I'd hoped he'd be. During the questioning, I realized he was not responding to me as I expected him until the mother pulled me aside and told me the child was on the spectrum. Well, I had no idea what the spectrum was. So I was ignorant, but one time, I didn't like the feeling of it. So what I did was I did self-reform, which led to judicial reform, and we were able to make great changes in Philadelphia, make it part of the fabric of Philadelphia family courts. I took that show on the road with the permission of my colleagues, and we've created what's autism in the court, and we've educated over 2,000 people. We dealt with the two different branches of government. As a result of that interest, we now have about 15 courthouses that have sensory rooms that are to be able to be used for anyone who's neurodiverse. We're educating and we're training our system partners. As a judge, how many times are we making the wrong decisions and destroying someone's life because we don't understand that they are a little different than we are? And it may be neuro, it may be cultural. There are so many different changes. Through that, the tsunami wave has bled into now behavioral health. And what I'm finding out during an inquiry is that we're using our prisons as de facto mental health facilities. And let me just end it this way. There's something wrong when we as judges and justices and we, the standard bearer of a justice system, say that if an individual with a mental issue behaves incorrectly in society, he gets treated and we call it a symptom of his diagnosis. But in prison, if someone acts up, we call it an infraction. And that infraction leads to further incarceration, isolation in a padded room. What are we doing as judges and justices? To me, the concept is why I believe in the tradition. Yes. and the concept of a stare decisis and a court system that is not an activist. I do believe that our procedures and our rules must adhere to the advancement of society's needs and purposes. Autism, we're now understanding. Behavioral health, we're now understanding. It's our time to do the right thing while we're here.
Thank you so much, Justice Dougherty. Justice Wecht, during your campaign, you advanced a 5-point plan on ethics and transparency. Talk about what's been accomplished and what remains on your agenda.
Well, first of all, one of the things that our court continues to look at is cameras in the courtrooms. As was mentioned, all of our arguments in Supreme Court are televised. Much of the Superior Court's work and Commonwealth Court is televised, but our trial courts are not. We have issues we need to look at on whether we ought to show trial court proceedings. There are problems with witness intimidation, there are problems with the performative aspects of trials, and there are problems with AI and the misuse of snippets of trials. And so we're still studying this. It remains an ongoing study. With respect to ethics and judicial education, we, all seven of us, adopted a very robust judicial education program, and it's really the pride of the nation. In fact, right now, here in Philadelphia, our judicial education department is hosting a national conference and teaching judicial educators from around the country about our program that brings in distinguished academics and distinguished jurisprudes and judges from around the nation to teach our judges at all levels. So I think we've really advanced judicial education, and that helps all Pennsylvanians. Yeah. Because you get judges who are more versed in current developments and in the foundations of the law as well.
You know, a lot of voters sit out off year elections like this one. Do you think the court should play a role in helping citizens recognize why it matters to engage and why the judiciary is so important to their daily lives? And if you do believe that, how do you think the courts should connect with ordinary Pennsylvanians? And I want you to take a minute for this one, and we'll start with you, Justice Dougherty, Justice Donahue, and Justice Wecht.
I can say for close to a quarter of a century, I sat in the first judicial district, that being the Philadelphia Court of Common Pleas. And I think the Philadelphia Court of Common Pleas does a heroic opportunity of reaching out to children in schools and adults and in the community with our civic education. And I'm sure, since I've been on this court, I've seen it expanding to the different counties. I do believe it's a function incumbent upon our administrative judges and our president judges of our local Court of Common Pleas to reach out to the community for which they represent.
We actually have a historical society as part of our court programs, and Justice Mundy, our colleague from Tioga County, she is spearheading that effort, which includes educational activities. Now, the place to start with education about the court system is in grade schools and high schools, because we have no civic education that has any way of getting people to understand how our courts work. We have no civic education about what the Pennsylvania Constitution is. We have no civic education that would lead anyone to believe that the judicial branch is equal to the legislative branch and the executive branch. And so our historical society, through its education effort, is really making an attempt at, I believe, the right level where we can reach, which is grade schools and high schools.
Yeah. Justice West.
Yes, the Historical Society actually includes a museum in the Judicial Center in Harrisburg, and there are kids who go there on field trips to learn about the courts, number one. Number two, our court system, we have a very strong public relations department, which connects on social media with people about the courts and which puts out press releases that teach, and including videos, by the way, that teach people about the court system. And the final thing I want to say is that judges at all levels are encouraged to go out to speak about the court system and to educate the public, including kids and also adults. Even when it's not an election year, I often receive an invitation and go to a high school or a college. So that's a thing that judges at all levels are becoming more sensitive to, particularly given the lack of civics education in our schools today.
Thank you. And as we wrap up, I want to look forward, because this is a retention election, and I want you to talk about your goals for a second term, if retained. This will be sort of like your closing statement. So I want each of you to take 90 seconds, tell us what your goals are and what you're looking forward to if retained for that second term.
I'm going to start with the proposition that the way our Constitution is set up, retention elections are nonpartisan. It's a yes-no vote. So you don't have a fist fight every 10 years. What you have at the end of a 10th year is a yes-no vote. How do we do our jobs? Now, what I'd like to do with the remainder of my term is to ensure that the efforts that we have made interpreting and applying the Pennsylvania Constitution continue. I want to be certain that the seeds that we've sown in terms of extending protections that have always been there but have not been recognized under the Pennsylvania Constitution continue to be recognized by the court that I sit on. And I think the stability of a retention election where I am retained, and frankly, Justice Wecht and Justice Daugherty retained, will ensure that type of stability going forward, which again, I believe, is what our Constitution intended with retention elections.
Wonderful. Justice Wecht, 90 seconds.
So two things. First of all, unlike folks in the executive and legislative branches, we don't have agendas or policies that we're trying to impose once we're elected. So Alexander Hamilton in Federalist 78 wrote, "The Congress has the purse, the president has the sword, and the courts have only judgment." So all we have is judgment. There's another important thing, though. Under Article 5 of Pennsylvania's Constitution, we have the administrative responsibility over the entire judicial system and also supervisory responsibility on aspects of the legal profession, licensing, discipline, and what have you. It would be my hope that our court can continue to advance the most modern, most transparent, and most fair procedures for rulemaking and for best practices for our Pennsylvania judiciary, including taking the temperature of what's going on around the country to find out if there's something that we can do better to help our courts do their job the best they can.
Final word, Justice Daugherty.
I truly believe in the independence of the judiciary. For those who go into the capitals, whether you're going to the governor's office or the mayor's office, they're serving one clientele or the other based upon your partisan beliefs. When you go into the General Assembly, they're serving the needs of the majority, whether it's one partisan party or the other. But those who seek remedy in the courts come in from all types of races, gender, creeds, nationality. We service everyone. There is no political position. Candidly, it's almost embarrassing that we as sitting justices are resorted to come here and play politic. But our system has it so that the retention vote is for Pennsylvanians and Pennsylvanians only to judge our judges based upon our oath to the Constitution to uphold it and to apply the law equally and fairly. I believe that the three of us have done that. However, this is an election, and I am home with my friends, and all politics is local, as Tip O'Neill said. So, unfortunately, it would be remiss of me if I didn't ask each and every one of you to consider this. Justice David Weck, Justice Christine Donahue, Justice Kevin Dougherty, we're on the ballot on November 4th. Would you please consider pressing yes for us so that we can serve you for another 10 years? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. That was Pennsylvania Supreme Court Justice Kevin Dougherty. He is up for retention next Tuesday alongside his colleagues, Justices David Wecht and Christine Donahue. Each of those three judges of our state's highest court joined me for a fireside chat at Central High School last month. Thank you to Pennsylvanians of Four Modern Courts and the Committee of 70 for organizing that forum.
The full conversation was broadcast by PCN and posted to their YouTube channel. Coming up, we're going to break down the politics of this race with a pair of pundits. What should Pennsylvanians do on November 4th, yay or nay? We're going to talk about it coming up on Studio 2. Don't go anywhere.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We just heard from the three Supreme Court justices who are up for a retention vote next Tuesday, Justices Kevin Dougherty, David Wecht, and Christine Donahue. We now are going to hear from two people with opposing views on the retention question. Joining us in our studio are Guy Shiraki, conservative commentator and writer for Real Clear PA and Broad and Liberty. Welcome back, Guy.
Nice to be back. Thanks.
Yes, we also have J.J. Abbott, a Democratic strategist and executive director of Commonwealth Communications. J.J., thanks so much for being here.
You got it.
To our listeners, we would love to get your thoughts on this upcoming election, yay or nay, and why. Email us, studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat. Guy, wanted to start with you. Just tell us why you think folks should be paying attention to this race, what you think the stakes are.
Sure. In the past, I've voted yes to retain Democrat and Republican judges and justices. I think this is different. These three justices vote together over 90% of the time, so most of the comments are universal. I think that they have failed the test. The basic test for judges, especially justices, is can you be fair and impartial, follow the Constitution, follow the law? And I think too often they failed. Like bad umpires at a softball game, they've interjected themselves into the game, they've changed the outcome. Whether it's been in issues of health care, reapportionment, elections, or COVID, all too often, they've thrown out bipartisan legislation, written their own laws, drawn their own lines, and they have violated sort of the tradition of judges of being umpires and referees and keeping things fair and balanced.
Quick follow-up, Guy. I think a lot of people will view that skeptically just from this lens. They'll say, wait a second, all of a sudden, when there's three Democrats up for retention, sure, we are finding sort of the fault in their opinions, whereas before, when that wasn't at stake, all of a sudden, we weren't finding all of these faults. How do you respond to that? People will question, I guess, the sincerity of your critique.
I'm so offended.
Well, a lot of people will, though.
My mom won't. Look, as I said, I voted yes in the past to retain most judges. Most of them are, you know, it's not a case of whether they agree with Guy Shiraki or not. It's, are you doing your job? Again, I think they're different. We had a bipartisan health care law that lasted for two decades. Democrat and Republican governors upheld it. These judges threw it out, which have contributed to health care costs. Pennsylvania, you know, everything's in the news today about gerrymandering and reapportionment. Pennsylvania was the first state to throw out their lines midterm. These judges in 2017 decided to get rid of the law that was passed by a bipartisan state house, was supported by bipartisan members. They threw it out. They not only threw out a bipartisan law, they drew their own lines. The election lines we used in 2018 or 2020 were drawn by these judges acting as super legislators. And during COVID, they gave Governor Wolf unfettered power. I mean, we're seeing a lot of protests today about kings, but the reality was for 2020 and 2021, Tom Wolf was essentially king of Pennsylvania, able to rule over our lives, and these folks didn't step in. So, look, take away COVID, take away upending bipartisan health care laws and having them not draw lines like legislators, they would just be garden variety judges. They violated the standard. It's only fair. In a state of 13 million people, we can find Democrats or Republicans to replace them who will follow the rule of law and be fair and impartial.
And all right, JJ, I want to get your response to all of that. We want to get into some of those issues specifically later. We will follow up. But the big question of what you think is at stake and why you think folks should vote to retain these judges.
Well, I think we're hearing in a lot of the communications from the no side are, both either misleading or kind of strenuous arguments. And they're all focused on these sort of niche issues of the past. But I think Pennsylvanians, when they go to vote in this election, need to think about the future. And what we're existing in the reality right now of what's happening in Washington, we have a Supreme Court in Washington that is tearing down institutions from our rights to our freedoms to protections that have been in place to keep people safe and to protect our environment, to protect workers, to protect healthcare access. And that makes our state Supreme Court the last line of defense that we have for a lot of these issues that are really vital to people. And I think these judges have been fair and impartial. I actually think one of the examples that Guy brings up is a really good example of how that is true. There were politicians in both parties who entered into a, frankly, fairly insidious deal to give Republicans significant advantages in the congressional maps in exchange for protecting Democratic incumbents at the time. And that was one of the most gerrymandered maps in the country. There was universal consensus among gerrymandering experts, from independent experts, that this map was obscene in a lot of ways. I mean, people in Pennsylvania remember Goofy kicking Donald Duck. Mm-hmm. I mean, I lived in this little piece of a map district that was connecting two pieces together so they could avoid another place and protect an incumbent Republican. And so these judges actually stood up to people in both parties, and they told these politicians that the law protected people's rights to fair and free elections. And that's why they threw that map out. And that kind of impartiality, that willingness to be able to stand up on the side of the Constitution, on the side of the law, is why these justices have all been recommended by the Pennsylvania Bar Association. People are getting advertising from all sorts of groups, but a trusted source of ratings for judicial candidates, and they don't always back them. They don't always. Yeah. Is the Pennsylvania Bar Association, which has universally said that these three should be kept on the court. And we also saw this week that the Philadelphia Inquirer came out very aggressively, the editorial board, in defining that the chaos that could happen if these justices are not retained. And I think it's really important that we have those folks, I think, are really good barometers for people listening right now of how the decision they should make, rather than sort of some of the misleading arguments that we've been hearing from the no side.
Yeah, and I just want to throw out there that we've only had one judge that was not retained since the retention vote sort of came into play in the 1960s. But I want to just like point this out and ask you a follow-up, JJ, and then get your thoughts on this guy. I mean, a decade ago, Pennsylvania's high court was rocked by scandals. People may have forgotten that. We had a porn email controversy. We had campaign corruption. We had justices having to resign. One was put on house arrest, okay? These justices have not had any hint of that. They provided some stability. And so I want to ask you, JJ, how much should the stability of the court be taken into consideration when you're determining this? Because if they are not retained, we got 2 years of possibly four justices, two Democrats, two Republicans, and we could be casting the chaos at a very critical time. Your thoughts?
Absolutely. I think there's a huge, huge risk on two fronts for if these justices are not retained. The first is this interim period where we could have really important cases, whether it's the 2026 election or there's a major case around reproductive rights that's moving its way through the state's court system right now that could determine whether women have equal access to reproductive care under the Pennsylvania Constitution. And those cases, along with a lot of others, could be either shifted in another direction, or they could just have no decision because there is a deadlock court that can't make a decision. But I think, honestly, to your point about the scandal, you know, we had a Republican court for a long time, and there were Democrats and Republicans on that court that got into trouble, no doubt about it. But one thing that I think is really key there is that, you know, that era of the court really did not hold the legislature accountable to the law. They allowed them to draw these maps in a way that really violated the law and people's rights. And so when you hear from the no side, you know, this idea that these justices have put their foot on the scale, it's like they put their foot on the scale for fairness. They put their foot on the scale in terms of protecting people's rights over, you know, special interests and powerful interests. And I think that's a really big shift that we should continue. We should make sure it continues.
I just want to backtrack a little bit because Margaret from Marion, PA, just was asking what happens if the three justices are not retained. I just want to lay out that scenario for folks if you're not aware. So what would happen is they would not be retained. They would not be on the court. There would be an interim period between then and 2027. In that interim period, the governor could nominate replacements. However, he would need a two-thirds majority
from
the state Senate. Mm-hmm. If you know how these things are laid out in Pennsylvania, finding common ground there is very unlikely. You're talking about finding three unicorns here. So there is a, let's say, likely scenario where these seats would not be filled until 2027. So you're shaking your head, Guy. Do you disagree with that assessment, or do you just – let's just talk generally about stability, because I would imagine you are somewhat concerned about that, but that your arguments against these justices just overweigh those concerns. Or walk us through your thinking on that.
Both. One is the idea that these folks have to stay 10 more years.
Right.
Well, otherwise we'll have chaos. I don't subscribe to that. If you're doing a bad job, sometimes it's good to have a change. And secondly, I know it may be hard, but there was a time where Democrats and Republicans worked together. We've had judges on the appellate courts. We've had justices pass away. We've had them reach retirement age. And Democratic governors have nominated replacements, and Republican governors have nominated replacements. One of the reasons our Constitution requires a two-third approval is that it's almost never the case that either party has two-thirds control of the Senate.
Right.
It's to force compromise. Mm-hmm.
So you think it's possible?
I have every faith that we can do it. It is possible. And again, I'm not looking for three Republicans. We'll settle that part at the election in the fall of 2027. We just need three people, and we have found in the past retired judges, law school deans, men and women who come in and do the job of being impartial in this.
And could keep the court functioning for a couple of years.
Right. So I don't subscribe to the idea there's chaos. It would be nice if the governor and the Senate, Democrats and Republicans, sat in a room and came up with a list of individuals who would go in as public servants and serve the 2 years and fulfill it. We've seen it happen in the past, and we should expect that much in the future.
And Guy, I mean, the one thing that you argued that these judges should not be retained, and as I mentioned, we've only had one judge not retained in the years since this became law. But I don't hear necessarily an argument, like you disagree with some of the outcomes that these justices reached. But I did not hear you say that they just broke, you know, long-held precedent, or that they did something where they absconded their duty under the law or something wild. It just seems to me it's a, you know, it's a purely partisan disagreement. And isn't that okay to disagree with the outcome as long as the justices follow the process? And they've all said, you heard them say, that it becomes... They are part of this political process, but it's an apolitical position.
Well, I wish it was an apolitical position, and it's not just simply that. Again, I voted to retain Democrat judges in the past. This is different. We had a bipartisan law on health care. The Democrat and Republican governors upheld and followed, and the legislature followed. They decided to get rid of it and to allow venue shopping, which drives up the cost of malpractice insurance for doctors, causes doctors to leave the state. We didn't need them to put their thumb on the scale and throw out a bipartisan law. And with all due respect to JJ, as we travel
around
the state...
Are you saying that them throwing it out was somehow illegal? That
yes,
it was an illegal...
It was inappropriate. Yes, they had no standard. They had no standing to do that. They had no standing to do that. The law had existed for over a decade. And when it comes to the legislature and redrawing lines, with all due respect, call me a little cynical, But in 2017, Eric Holder creates a PAC for the sole purpose of taking over state legislative processes to redraw the lines. And 6 months later, they're in front of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, where that those judges throw out a bipartisan passed law and then draw their own lines. There's no precedent for judges drawing lines. I just want to argue that it's not Eric Holder.
It was the League of Women Voters, one of the oldest nonpartisan groups in Pennsylvania.
The League of Women Voters are not nonpartisan. The Pennsylvania Bar Association is not nonpartisan. The Philadelphia Inquirer is not a neutral observer. I mean, we need to
I really disagree with that. I think that's like that sort of pushing us into where like everything now is partisan. But, you know, the Inquirer, certainly the Inquirer editorial board, especially if you've been reading the last few years, has been pretty tough on a lot of Democrats from the
city
to the state.
Can I refocus the question for you, JJ?
Sure,
because obviously you guys disagree about this. I do think, though, there's this healthy skepticism among some voters to say, like, wait a second. These people run as Democrats, then they say they sort of shed their partisan labels, but it's just a coincidence that they rejected this map that was favorable to Republicans, or it's just a coincidence that they made these rulings that Democrats do seem to agree with on abortion or other issues. And so I think that's where some of the pushback comes in, that people just don't buy the idea that they can really shed their partisan skin when they do originally run on party lines or as members of a certain party.
I just think like, you know, we have conservative and liberal justices at every level of the court, and people have ideology, and that is what it is. But I would just disagree with the idea that they've been partisan. You certainly could disagree, like Guy does, with their ideology, but when you look at their decisions, most of those decisions are actually quite bipartisan, in the sense of they went after bipartisan politicians who rigged the maps to benefit the politicians. One of the big issues that the other side has made is around elections, and they make this big deal about people during the pandemic getting 3 extra days to return their mail-in ballot because the USPS said that they couldn't, their rights might be infringed. And the Supreme Court said, okay, 3 extra days, that's it, one time, because we're in this thing where people's rights may. But those were ballots of people of all parties, Democrats, Independents, and Republicans. They also, just to fact check this, had no bearing on the presidential race because Donald Trump lost by 80,000 votes, not 10,000. And so I just think like the arguments that are being made are partisan against them. But these folks have actually made decisions that some Democrats don't like. They like the Democrats who there are Democrats that were affected by these new maps in a way that where they lost places that they wanted to represent. So I think, you know, we went from having a map that was like 13-5 Republican to Democrat in a state that's 50-50 to a map that's 9-9, that was 9-9 and then now is 10-8. And so that's incredibly fair. That's making it in line with the state's partisanship.
We do have to leave it there. Obviously, the voters will have the final say next week. Want to thank both of our guests, Guy Shiraki from Real Clear Pennsylvania and Broad and Liberty. Always a pleasure to have you, Guy.
Thank you.
And J.J. Abbott, Democratic Strategist, Executive Director of Commonwealth Communications. J.J., thanks for being here as well.
Thanks so much.
And thank you to everybody who wrote in and commented. I'm glad you're going to be voting next week.
Everybody vote.
Yes. Thank you so much to our producers, Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. We had special help today from Paige Murray-Bessler. Thank you so much, Paige. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, Al Banks and Tina Calique, engineered today's show. Editing our executive producer, Kevin McCrory, from Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman. Aaron.